From his groundbreaking transcriptions of Radiohead to his unforgettable interpretations of classic and new repertoire, pianist Christopher O'Reilly has redefined the possibilities of classical music. He has dazzled the world over on stage, on the radio, and on his records. His memorable interpretations of traditional and popular repertoire make him a bridge between musical tastes, genres, and audiences worldwide. Christopher O'Reilly will be on the stage of the Colonial Theater in Pittsfield on Friday night at 8 o'clock. It is a great pleasure to have him with us this morning on the Roundtable. Christopher, good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Gearing up to getting there. I was actually playing in Vermont over the weekend, flew into Albany Airport. I imagine we have you guys to thank for the good music playing over at the airport, yes?
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, hope. So how's everything? Has this been any relaxation this summer for you?
Oh, gosh, no. I'm just listening to the first edits of this next record coming out on Oxengale, a record we might as well call Slash List, because all of the pieces are, I guess, in my ilk, arrangements that List has made, or in one case, that List has contributed to. It includes the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, complete in the List arrangement. A couple of song transcriptions by Schubert and Schumann, the Don Juan Fantasy, based on Mozart's Don Giovanni, and the Prelude and Liebestod, which will feature on the first half of my program at Pittsfield this week. I wanted to make it a List sort of celebration when I came up with that part of the program, but List only transcribed the Liebestod, didn't do the Prelude, and I think the Prelude is really some of the most remarkable and important music of the opera. So there were occasional, I think there was one complete transcription of the Prelude, but really it doesn't sound very good on the piano. I mean, there's just no disguising it. It's not a lush string orchestra. And so I found a Moskowski arrangement of the Prelude and Liebestod. And Moskowski does a nice condensed version of the Prelude. It's one page long. So you get the motives, but you don't miss the magic of the orchestra. And then we proceed into the Liebestod, and I found that quite a lot of Moskowski was sometimes, well, to me anyway, preferable to the List, so I've made a sort of a mashup of those two versions. And then when it came time for the climactic parts of Isolde's aria at the end, neither List nor Moskowski had transcribed that material. So, and I was kind of puzzled. I thought maybe it was superstition or whatever, and it certainly wasn't because they were men who, you know, were lacking fingers in any way. So I've decided to shoehorn in Isolde's line, and so we will be having the Prelude and Liebestod in the Wagner List Moskowski O'Reilly version on concert on Friday.
How do you define your ilk?
Well, I play what I love, and sometimes that leads me to play things that are not initially intended for the piano, although I think in a lot of cases, particularly in Stravinsky, all of his music originated at the piano. He composed at the piano, and so things like the Apollon Musagete, which I contributed greatly to making a piano version based on, of course, the transcription or the arrangement, the reduction that was obviously used and is used for ballet productions. I made the recording of that, and of course, I've been always fascinated with the boundaries of the piano and the boundless quality of sound and color available. So I'm always drawn to those composers who are, you know, masters of extending the boundaries of the instrument. Stravinsky, Rachmaninoff, I'll be playing his second sonata on the program on Friday. Scriabin, Ravel, those are the folks who really bring all the magic out of the instrument. And I think playing music intended for orchestra or a string quartet or a rock band is a nice way of saying, yes, this is the instrument that can emulate and in many ways elucidate, you know, the meaning and color behind orchestral or ensemble performances.
Is that magic of the instrument still an exploration and a mystery to you?
I think it is. I mean, I still find, you know, even in the early 20th century, you know, you have folks like Henry Cowell and you know, people really using the inside of the instrument and utilizing all kinds of aspects of the piano that I still find quite mysterious. I also think that there's quite a lot to be done, quite a lot to be learned from harpsichord players, where, you know, we're on the piano, we're always concerned with phrasing as an aspect of getting louder or softer, and on the harpsichord you really have to deal with the minutiae of, you know, the space between the notes and how one addresses similar situations in phrasing that can't just be reduced to matters of volume. You really get into the quite nice aspect of timing and how that can really relate quite a lot to how one makes a phrase. Somebody actually on CBS News asked Pablo Casals, the cellist, many years ago, you know, what the hardest thing to do on the cello was. And I'm sure they were expecting some smart alecky answer, like, you know, fingered tenths or something. But he said, getting from one note to another. And I think that's probably the hardest part of playing any instrument and making any kind of music is the decisions one makes, getting from one place to the next.
When you started your career, did you realize, I mean, was it at all a conscious effort to provide this bridge that I mentioned in the introduction, or was it a very natural progression for you to just do what you felt was right?
Well, I had been interested in popular music when I was in grade school, and when I was growing up in Pittsburgh, I played a regular weekend jazz gig, and so when I went to New England Conservatory, it was the idea that, I don't know, I went there because, you know, Gunther Schuller was president, and I thought I could pursue both. And then when I realized, you know, with some sort of humbling sentiment, that there really is a history of jazz, and my sort of takes on my favorite jazz players of the era I was interested in, you know, Bill Evans and Chick Corea and Keith Jarrett and McCoy Tyner, were based on their sort of revolutionary sort of reworkings of jazz language, and not realizing that they had steeped themselves in early jazz and bebop and had forged their language out of a thorough and encyclopedic knowledge of that language. And so I didn't really think it was fair of me to, you know, to have to go back and reinvent the wheel and really learn that literature when I already had a pretty fair grasp of where I wanted to go in the classical realm. And I also thought that it was reinventing or you know, reinterpreting the classical works was in a large extent a much more gratifying challenge than, you know, my spontaneous nightly musings on Straight No Chaser. You know, I really, you know, you can have a sort of an off night in jazz club. You can't really have an off night on the classical stage. It's a real challenge. It's a real tightrope. And so I thought that was more of a challenge to me. And so it wasn't until long after school. So I was really, you know, very much devoted to classical music and really gave up on my jazz and pop leanings. But when we started from the top, the idea was to have a program that would celebrate kids playing all kinds of music, and that was a really cool thing. You know, we had our initial pizza parties where we get to know the kids and they play for each other, and I work with the kids that I'm collaborating with. And first of all, you've got a Juilliard prep violinist looking at the LaGuardia High School jazz quintet and having this revelatory experience of seeing musicians playing music and actually having a good time doing it, you know, not worrying about crossing their T's, et cetera. So that was something. And then later on, the trombone player, you know, comes up to me and says, you know, the trombone player in the jazz quintet, you know, I saw you were doing a Beethoven concerto with the New York Philharmonic recently. You know, it's always been a dream of mine to play in a section in a Mahler symphony. So the kids have always had a, you know, or do now, especially because of YouTube and the great variety of music available to them, genres and everything, that they're interested in all kinds of music. And it was sort of too bad that when we actually started shopping the show around, it was generally to classical radio stations. And they said, you know, you play 1 minute of jazz and you're off. We're just not interested. And so in my way, it was sort of thumbing my nose at that sort of attitude, where I had my solo spot with the midway point where, you know, we didn't want our kids at the whim of local stations who would use that break time to either take what we sent them to play or break away and take care of local business. So that was my solo spot. So I started doing arrangements of Radiohead and other things, and our announcer would post-announce these pieces. You know, that was our host, Christopher O'Reilly, playing Karma Police by Radiohead. And we started getting, and you know, basically, you know, I'm a classical pianist, and people figured I was playing something classical. We got some mail into the show saying, "Who is this Mr. Head, and where can I find more of his beautiful music?" And so, you know, that was, you know, so we were doing good things and running on all cylinders. So that was a good thing.
When you look now and with what you're doing with Liszt, and it does seem to be more of a classical repertoire, though.
Well, it is, and yet in a way it isn't, because as I say, you know, if there's something that isn't working, you know, I have the confidence of having worked with living composers to realize that, you know, if there was one right way of doing things, there wouldn't be any reason to interpret things. So, you know, there are places in the Berlioz, for instance, that I recorded, where Liszt, you know, puts up a third staff of stuff that's also going on in the orchestra, but he didn't really have time to, you know, arrange that. So I've had to, you know, take roughly the whole development section of the first movement of the Berlioz and, you know, rework it so that it works inclusive of all that material that Liszt left out. I took the tolling bells of the finale in the Dies Irae section and decided that would be a nice way to do that would be to really, instead of making them left-hand octaves, to really include, you know, all of the overtones of a really, you know, really gnarly-sounding bell tone. And so that involves, you know, a little bit of knowledge of a series of overtones and sort of making a sort of a pianissimo veil in my right hand of those overtones to accompany the tolling bells in octaves in the left hand. So yeah, there's even in you know, sort of standard repertoire, there's been a fair amount of reworking. I also remember, you know, my first record was a Busoni record, and I did the his version of the Mephisto Waltz. It was kind of a transcription thrice removed. You know, Liszt made the orchestra version, he made the piano version, and then Busoni ostensibly made a piano version based on the orchestral version. Of course, the leaping octaves page of the Liszt version doesn't exist in this Busoni version, and so I thought, well, you know, if I don't put that one back in, people are just going to think I didn't practice hard enough. So even that one was sort of an amalgam. So I've been doing this sort of all along.
Well, it should be just a wonderful evening in the Berkshires at the Colonial on Friday night at 8 o'clock. Christopher O'Reilly will be on the stage. You can find out more information by going to berkshiretheatergroup.org, berkshiretheatergroup.org. Christopher, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us this morning, and we enjoy having you here in the Berkshires.
Pleasure. Looking forward to it. You have
great pleasure. Thank you very much. Again, you can find out more information about Christopher O'Reilly at the Colonial on Friday night at 8 o'clock by going to berkshiretheatergroup.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.